Welcome to Conversations with Big Rich. This is an interview-style podcast. These interviewed are all involved in the off-road industry. Being involved, like all of my guests are, is a lifestyle, not just a job. I talk to past, present, and future legends, as well as business owners, employees, media, and land use warriors, men and women who have found their way into this exciting and addictive lifestyle we call off-road. We discuss their personal history, struggles, successes, and reboots. We dive into what drives them to stay active in off-road. We all hope to shed some light on how to find a path into this world that we live and love and call off-road. This episode of Conversations with Big Rich is brought to you by the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame. The mission of the Hall of Fame is to educate and inspire present and future generations of the off-road community by celebrating the achievements of those who came before. We invite you to help fulfill the mission of the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame. Join, partner, or donate today. Legends live at ormhoff.org. On this week's episode of Conversations with Big Rich, I'll be speaking with Butch Frank Arciero. He is the second of three generations of racers, a 2019 Ormhoff inductee. He's also a member of the Ormhoff Board of Directors and a super nice guy that has been just a pleasure to get to know. And here we go. Frank Arciero, it is great to finally get you on this interview for this podcast. I know we've been working on this for a month or so. And I really appreciate you spending the time. I know you're a real busy man, but I really appreciate you coming on and spending the time. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Rich, for asking me to come on. And I really, truly appreciate it. I appreciate all you do for our sport of off-road racing, even though this interview is kind of personal and what have you. But you do a tremendous amount for Ormhoff, and we need more people like you to be able to grow what we're trying to do and accomplish.
Well, thank you. I'm the new guy, so I have all the energy. You know, it's all new to me.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's start off, you know, where were you born and raised?
I was actually born in Culver City, California, 1946. And my dad and mom had moved here from Detroit. And my dad worked for a gentleman that built houses in Torrance. His name is Tony Padovano. And then my dad lived in, bought a duplex in Culver City. And I was there for, when I was born, probably maybe another 6 or 7 months. And then he moved to Montebello, California. And I basically is where my roots began, is in Montebello.
Okay. And your dad, he immigrated from Italy to the United States when he was 14. Is that correct?
That's correct. Both him and my mom both immigrated out here. They were on, I think my mom was on the last ship that came out of Naples to the United States before they stopped all the shipping and all the passenger ships when the war broke out.
Oh, wow. Wow. I'm glad they got out of there.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
You know, imagine what life would have been like if there had been no World War II and that you would have grown up in Italy.
Yeah, no, you know what, Rich, I swear to God, I do think about that once in a while. And I mean, I had the great opportunity. Actually, my dad took us back there a couple different times, and I think 61, and then I think about the latter part, 69 or 70. But I had the opportunity to take, and Ryan and Robert, my two boys and my daughter, Jacqueline, they've been back there with us too. But I was able to take the entire family, not only Ryan, his family, Jacqueline and her family, and Robbie and his family, and me and my wife. And we all went back to where my mom and dad were born. We were in Rome, and they were about halfway between Rome and Naples, out of a community called Cassino. Monte Cassino was a big deal during the war. There was a monastery up there. And my mom was about maybe 4 miles over the hills into a little community called Atina. and I was able to take everybody back there, and we visited both places, and
oh, wow.
I was just. You know, the thing for me was the grandkids. You know, they never got to meet other than Presley, which is the oldest grandchild. I've got seven of them, and they never got to meet their grandfather, and none of them met their grandmother. Okay, she had passed. My mom passed away in 99. So anyhow, long story short, I had the opportunity, and we went to both hometowns, and the kids just. You know, just listening to them and having them look at where they lived, okay, and what they did. And, I mean, two of the boys, the middle one, or the second oldest, Luke, and his son, I mean, his brother Rocco, they were standing there by my dad's house, and they looked at me, and they call me Yappy, not Grandpa, they call me Yappy. For some reason, the oldest one couldn't say something, I got stuck with Yappy. So they go, Yappy, says, This is where my great grandpa lived, and I go, yeah, right here. And he says, well, man, he says, where's the drinking fountain? I said, there's no drinking fountains. I said, what they had to do is they had to walk down. The mom had to walk down, get the water out of the river, and bring it back up, and that's how they cleaned themselves and drank. And then the other one goes like this, and it was in July, so it was like 190 something degrees. So Luke says, well, how about didn't they have air conditioning? I go, yeah, they did. I says, look up here. I says, see that little hole in the wall? I said the air would come through, you know, come blowing up during the streets and go through that little wall, and then that's how they got cooled down. Because you got to be kidding me,
right?
And it was just to see their, you know, and so I say to myself, what would I have done back then, you know? And I don't know. I mean, it was just, you know, these things work out for God has a reason why everything works out, but it would have been, you know. I'm sure a really interesting lifestyle and an interesting life. So.
Right. Absolutely a lot different. Absolutely.
That for sure. For sure.
So when you were growing up and, you know, what did the family do for entertainment? I know your dad worked in construction, but those younger years as a family, did you guys go camping or out into the desert or, What did your family enjoy?
No, well, basically, it was like a work schedule. My dad worked like 6-7 days a week, so it wasn't really where we had a lot of time together. And you know, it's just I didn't see him very often, other than on Sundays when we went to church and what have you. But you know, we would go. He had a passion in regards to visiting relatives that had migrated out here to immigrated into the United States also. So we had a bunch of relatives that lived down in the Torrance area and what have you. And on Sundays, that's what we do. We'd just pack up and my dad would take us down and visit our relatives and we'd, you know, learn about them and, you know, what they did and how they got here. And then my dad, you know, he worked for, like I said, a guy named Tony Padovano, and then he started his own business in the concrete business, and he started doing concrete foundations for a lot of the builders in Southern California. Became one of the biggest, you know, subcontractors of concrete in Southern California area, and then his big passion, you know, as we grew up was. Well, let me step back.
Sure.
One of the things that we did is he loved to invest in properties, okay? And he wanted to grow things. He had a green thumb. And so so our deals on weekends was he bought a piece of property, 160 acres in Lancaster. And we used to go out there on weekends and clear the land. That's what our deal was. He'd bring a grader out there and he'd drive it and we'd supply the gas and the water and put it in there and do all the cleaning up around the property and what have you. And that's kind of what we did. Okay.
Right.
So it was a learning process, in regards to, you know, I guess his big deal was to try and make sure that we learned the value of work, the value of hard work, and what you can accomplish.
Right, and I think that those generations that immigrated into the United States came from obviously a different lifestyle, but you know it was about work and family was you know, around church on Sundays. You know, if you look back at the movies and stuff like that, it's, you know, they learned at a very young age that you had to work to survive. And once they immigrated to the United States, you know, those immigrants were really the foundation of the growth in the United States, no matter what country they've come from. And, you know, I think that's very honorable. And maybe as the generations go on, we lose some of that, you know, where we fall more into the typical United States type thing where, you know, there's more vacation time and stuff like that. But, you know, I think back onto some of the stories that I've heard about some of my relatives that immigrated in the early 1900s and late 1800s. And it was all about, you know, what they could do to better their life by having more money and being able to do things like that. So that all related to work. You know, the kids went to work, you know, high school years was, you know, it was spent working.
Yeah. No, I concur with you 100%. I know, you know, because me and my brother Albert, I mean, I had a younger brother, Robert, who passed away in early 2000. And then myself and my brother Albert, and us, you know, Albert and myself were basically, you know, we used to race together and everything else. So we, you know, we grew up knowing what hard work was. And that's all then weekends, like I said, that's what we did. We worked
right all
the time. And it just, you know, it made me appreciate, you know, what my dad actually went through, you know, even though sometimes I was, how do I say it? I was mad that I didn't, you know, that I played a lot of sports in high school, grammar school. And, you know, he very seldom had the opportunity to come because he was working. But then after growing up, you know, I realized, that's what he wanted to do was make sure they took care of his family. And unfortunately, if it took, you know, being away a little longer than natural, than normal, then, you know, it's going to be for the better of everybody. So,
right.
But it was, and I agree with you. I mean, it's just, in today's environment, I just wish that a lot of these kids had the same opportunities that we had growing up. And I think they would think a lot differently of how life is now and, what we can do and not do. So,
right. Hopefully we can instill those into at least our portion of those generations, those work ethics and the priority, set the priorities. So, you know, I mean, I look at, you know, my kids and my grandkids and I see that happening. So that makes me happy, you know, where I see other families where I'm wondering like, wow, you know, that's free range parenting. You know,
no, exactly. I agree.
So let's, you know, you said you played sports in school. How were you as a student?
Actually, that's a good question. When I was in grammar school, we went to, actually, we were, when we first moved to Montebello, there was no Catholic schools. And so we went to a public school for kindergarten, I think first grade. And then they built a church, Miraculous Medal in Montebello, and they built a school too. And so my second year was in Catholic school. So I think between second grade and maybe fourth grade, I really wasn't a real good student. Okay. And, I don't know why, maybe just wandering off and what have you. And then I remember we had nuns. There were the, Sisters of Charity and I remember one nun took a liking to me, and so she had pulled me aside three or four times about, you know, getting my grades up and what have you. And she promised, she says, "Listen, Frank, I will, you know, you get a good grades in this next semester, and I'm going to give you a present. And I go, "Oh my God!" So I busted my butt, and I got, you know, A's and B's, and she gave me a present. It was a Bible. So I go. And so, I mean, just from that standpoint and going forward, that my grades started becoming better and better. And from then on, I was a good student. I mean, all through the balance of grammar school and high school, I got good grades. And I was kind of always a goody two shoes to the teachers because I was always, you
looking
know,
for that present.
Favorites. Why, I don't know. No, yeah, exactly, for the present.
So then, what kind of sports did you play?
I played football, baseball, basketball, okay. And through grammar school and high school.
Excellent.
And a couple of years in college.
Oh, nice. Okay. And what was your major in college?
It was actually started out as an engineer major because my dad wanted me to, you know, get into the business. And so I went to Long Beach State. And my second year of Long Beach State, my dad was building a big apartment complex in Montebello. He had bought some land, and part of it was residential houses, and there was two or three big apartment buildings. The first apartment building that had it's a high rise, a three story apartment building with an elevator. And so during the summertime is where we worked. I played baseball and, you know, on the weekends, and then during the week I'd work over there in the summertime before school started again. And what happened was there was a strike and there were some problems on the job site. And so my dad fired the superintendent and told me, he says, okay, now I want you to finish running this job because we need to get this apartment done. So I said, okay. And I figured it was going to be done by, I think we started school, in September. And unfortunately, it wasn't, you know, we were having some issues. And I didn't go back to school. I finished that project, got it done, and then from there he put me in charge of other projects. So I had 2 years of college, and the rest of it was working for the company, for my dad's company, then on.
Well, you know, that's good schooling as well. I mean, it wasn't like you just dropped out and, you know, went surfing or something like that. You were learning the trade from the inside out.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because I was first digging ditches, foundations, and then from there, you know, like I said, this one here, I got into there and I got to be able to learn how to, he did all the bidding and what have you, but would give me copies of the contracts so I know, you know, who's going to do the cabinet work and who's going to do the balance of whatever we're going to do to finish the project up. And I learned quite a bit. I mean, a lot. So it was really a great education for me.
And how long did you stay in construction?
My whole life, I'm still in it.
Okay.
Ever since then, my dad started. We started a company called Arciero and Sons. Actually, to step back, my dad first deal he started. He was a concrete contractor, and then my uncle Phil, his brother, was in the Korean War. When he got out, my dad offered him a position and some interest in the concrete company. So my uncle took it over from there, and then in I think early or mid 60s, we started a company called Arciero and Sons, which was a corporation that stock was owned by myself, my brother, and my dad. And he branched out and we started building houses. We did a tremendous amount of building in the Whittier area, in Roland Heights, La Mirada, all over the place. And then just start building from then on, just kept going. And that's what we're doing now. We just, we're not as big now because I, you know, things have changed in that industry tremendously.
Yeah.
So we do other things. I mean, we're doing a big project right now in Riverside, and I've got two other partners, Jim Guthrie and Bud Felkamp, who are Bud's in the Hall of Fame and Jim is an ex-off-road racer.
Right.
And we've got a pretty big project in Riverside we're doing right now.
Excellent. And so, how I read that your dad, I believe, was involved with the championship auto racing team's CART.
Yes.
How did that all evolve? From contracting to was that a passion of his? Was automobiles?
Automobiles was a passion with his. When he came, like I said, when he came to this country, he lived in Detroit for 2 years and then moved to California. And went to work for a gentleman named Tony Padovano. And Tony was a big builder, like I said, in the Torrance area, and built thousands and thousands of houses after the war and what have you. And Tony was his hometown. He was born in Italy, and his hometown was probably 5 or 7 miles from where my dad was raised. And he Tony, he went to work for Tony, became real good friends. And Tony was in the automobile racing. The saying goes back in those days that Mr. Padovano had more Ferraris in the United States than Mr. Enzo Ferrari had in Italy.
Oh, wow.
And, okay. And my dad used to go to the races and said, you know, one of his dreams, and because he always told us, is one of the things I always wanted to do is own a race car. So after he told Tony he wanted to start his own company. So Tony said, fine. So he left, started his own company, and did the work for Tony, did the foundations and what have you in the houses that Tony had built. And then my dad bought a 2-liter Ferrari and actually drove it in a couple club races. Back then, the SCCA was, they had club racing. And then the insurance company found out and told my dad, said, you know, you can't drive a car and be insured, you know, for what you're doing. So my dad hired a driver. His name was Bob Drake, who drove the 2-liter. And then my dad sold that and bought a 4.9 Ferrari, a full-fledged race car. And Bob Drake drove that, I think, one or two races. And then somebody had come to my dad and says, hey, listen, I have a young kid that's pretty good, and I think he would fit well with you. And his name is Dan Gurney.
Oh, wow.
And and so my dad says, fine. So they took him to a test in Willow Springs, and Dan had got in the Ferrari and went around, came back in and changed some tires, went back out and beat the track record by 3 seconds or something. And so my dad hired him. So Dan drove the 4.9 Ferrari for 2 or 3 years until that was like 58, 59. And then in 60, he went back to England and met with Mr. Colin Chaplin, and my dad bought a Lotus 19, brought it out here, and then Dan drove that and said, you know, won races all over the United States.
Right.
So, and then he decided to go, he went to Indy in 1950, I think it was like 59 or 58 or 59. He bought a car. And the car he bought was one that Billy Vukovich had got killed in. Oh. And he bought it, and a guy named Shorty Templeman was driving it, and unfortunately didn't qualify because my dad at that time wanted to run the car, but he wanted to put a Maserati motor in it, and they were having problems with the pistons burning for whatever reason. Or rods, I'm sorry, the rods going away. So anyhow, long story short, he didn't qualify, and so he sold the car, and then bought, as I'd say, between 60 with the sports cars, and then up until maybe the early 80s, and then he bought another Champ car, and the CART organization was actually run by USAC at one time.
Right.
And then a bunch of the owners were upset at the rules and regulations that USAC had. So they broke away and they started CART. And my dad was one of the founding fathers of CART.
Wow.
And it was, you know, from there, you know, he stayed there for years and years. And then we got out of it. And I think it was like 2000 and early 2000. Decided to, you know, the funding and everything else was getting so expensive that, you know, he wanted to do other things with the money, and decided to buy some land and build a winery.
There you go. Safer.
Yeah. Exactly. So
that's great. I was way into racing, especially the Indy style cars. And I remember all of that with the separation and CART, and then, you know, everything that's happened over the years with that.
Yeah.
That's great. Wow. Cool.
Yeah. No, he loved it. I mean, like I said, he loved racing. And then when we got involved in off-road racing, you know, he liked it. And so he says, you know, my dad had a good friend of his, that he met through building, and he was the president of a savings loan called Southern California Savings and Loan. And he told me, me and Albert, he said, listen, I want to buy a car, and I want to build a 2-seat car so I can bring, his name was Ken Childs, Mr. Childs. he loves racing too, and I want to race some off-road races with him. So we bought a two-seater, we bought a Funko, and he raced that a couple, I think two or three times.
Great. So let's talk about how then you got into racing. I mean, you obviously you're around a racing family at that point, but especially off-road.
Yeah, well, being involved in the racing part of it, during when I was working out in the field, learning the concrete part of the business, we had a job out near Westlake Village. Okay, a concrete job we were doing, and the gentleman that was the superintendent for the developer who was building it out, we became friends. He wanted to talk to me all the time at lunchtime because he knew my dad was involved in racing. And anyhow, his name was Larry Denovitz, and he did some off-road racing. And so he told me, he said, Frank, it says, you know, I started prior to that, I was racing motorcycles, desert motorcycles. Me and my brother, we did that for 5 or 6 years and really loved doing it. So at this time, Larry says, hey, he says, I have a car. If you guys are interested, it was 1972, and he says, if you're interested, I'm selling it. And so I came home, I told Albert, and I said, are you interested in buying this car? And I said, yeah, let's go look at it. He said, let's go look at it. So we drove out there to Larry's place, and it was a home built car. It wasn't like a Funko or a Chenoweth or something. It was just a home built off-road car. And we said, yeah. And we made a deal with them. We bought it, and we raced it. Their first race was in Palmdale, and I don't know what happened. We broke or something. And then our second race was actually the Mint 400, the year that Parnelli won it in 1973.
Wow.
And that kind of just projected us out to say, you know. So we raced that car two races, and then we said, hey, you know, this is – the car didn't really – we had issues with the way it was built and what have you. So we sold it and then bought a Funko. And started racing off-road with Funkos.
That is so just, that's great.
Yeah, I know it was. I know it was. It's how things happen to you know. Somebody opens the door for you, and you kind of look at it, and you like it, and you start it. So, but it was. I tell you what, off-road racing. You know, like I said, I've been involved in. When I say involved, with my dad. My brother did more. He actually worked on the Indy cars and those cars during the course of summer times when we were out of school. And I did. I played baseball and what have you. So I wasn't involved in that. But still, from a standpoint of watching and growing up with the sport, and then also having the opportunity to race in off-road racing, it really opened up my eyes. I mean, the first two or three years. And I think it probably took us 4 years before we won a race. It was just a mind. It was just something you're saying to myself, you know, man, these guys are going so fast. And it was like we were, we couldn't keep up until we, you have that one opportunity to have a good vehicle. And now all of a sudden things turn around and it opens the door and you start saying, well, shoot, I can compete with these guys and then start winning, it was a great, great, great deal. I tell you, off-road racing, to me, is the hardest form of racing around because you have a lot of different things that you have to go through versus, in pavement racing. How many turns you have. You got a road course or any flat oval going around, what have you. So, but off-road racing, man, you run into so many different things, and it really opened our eyes, and I truly loved it. I mean, it was a challenge, and it was something that we really enjoyed, both me and my brother.
So then, your second race, you said, was the Mint 400, but it took you about 4 years to where you guys won your first race. Do you remember that first win?
Yes, it was a race in. There was an organization out of Fresno called AMSA, AMSA, and they had races. They raced at California City, and then also some, what do you want to call it, short course races in Fresno and Tulare and those areas. But this one in Cal City was a full-fledged desert race, and it was cool. It was cool to us because we own like 3,000 acres in Cala City. We were farming all the time. We're in the alfalfa business also. So, you know, it was kind of a, how do I say it? It turned out really great for us to be able to be competing in something that, you know, we had some dealings in property up there too.
Right.
But anyhow, long story short, it was the first race and it was, and we won. It was a 300-mile race, and at that time we finally were able to have two cars, one for Albert and one for myself, and then I won that race 3 years in a row. So nice. That kind of started us, and you know, as knowing that we can compete.
When was your first race in Baja?
First race in Baja had to be. We were kind of scared to go down there because we weren't really, you know, understanding, you know, going down into Mexico and what have you. But I'd say it was 19. Okay, I'd say probably 80, maybe 81, 82 would be our first race in Baja, maybe.
Okay, and what was that experience like for you being that first time, and then knowing that you had some trepidation going down there?
It was totally different. I mean, once we got down there and you know, got a lot of help from a lot of our people that, you know, that we raced against in regards to giving me experiences of where to go, what to do, and what have you, it was eye-opening. I mean, it was like, you know, hey, why are people hesitant in coming down here? And it was just, I tell you what, it was just unbelievable. We had a great, great time, and unfortunately, we didn't finish the first two or three races down there, but it opened our eyes as to knowing we can go down there, have a good time, and the people are really friendly and very cordial.
What's your most memorable story or incident from being in Baja?
Got it. There's a ton of them. I swear to God. I mean, when I had the opportunity to race with Toyota, with PPI, Cal Wells, my teammate was Ivan Stewart. You know, everybody knows him.
Yeah.
And we pre-ran down there. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of miles pre-running. And from a racing standpoint, and from a pre-run standpoint, you know, pre-running, we had a lot of deals that we, you know, ran across some people and run across people in certain areas that you say, you know, what the hell they're doing down here. And then from a racing standpoint, just, I guess, how do I say it? What would be the, if there was one, it was when I was racing the class 4 truck for McPherson. And I remember we started in Ensenada, and I think it was the 500, and we went out near the cement factory and in near some houses. And I remember everybody telling me prior to this, you know, if you go, you're in an area and you have a lot of people there, be careful because there might be some kind of a booby trap. Well, this one here, it was, I don't know, it was right on a road next to a house, and these guys dug a hole that had to be 15, 20 feet long and about 15 or 20 feet wide and about 4 feet deep. Ooh. And coming out of a turn and hitting that thing and just dust flying all over the place and not knowing where I was. You know, that, but from, I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. I don't have any one particular deal that happened to me down there, to be honest with you.
Okay. The, typically it's, you know, somebody will say, well, it's this win. Everybody, what I found is with the races that I've put on and the rock crawls that I've put on is everybody's favorite event is the one that they won.
But
best stories always seem to come out of the people that didn't win, the ones that struggled. Is there a race, particular race that you had that you can remember that was just a struggle to try to complete, or maybe you didn't complete that, you know, everything just seemed to be against you?
Well, I mean, from a standpoint of everything being against you, I mean, that you know, from the terrain and stuff, but not really. I mean, I've had some, from a standpoint of having tremendous, you know, let's say bad luck, or if you want to call it bad luck. I mean, there's a couple instances. I remember the one in particular is the 1,000 that went from Ensenada. I'm sorry. Yeah, from Ensenada to La Paz when we started that year. I can't remember what year it was. And I was teamed up with Bob Gordon. Me and Bobby were teammates for many years after the after I drove Toyota, the truck. And I remember that race. We started, and I was going all the way down to Ignacio and gave the car to Bob and Ignacio. And I remember, you know, our big issue with the car, that car that we drove, was ring and pinions. It was just a deal where you had to be very careful with the ring and pinions. And I remember taking that car, and I don't remember where we started, wherever we started, I think 8th or 10th two-seater. And by the time we got down the coast, we were the first car on the road. And I gave the car to Bob and Ignacio. We were the first car on the road, and we had, like, I'm going to say this and you're going to laugh at me, we had close to an hour lead on the second place car.
Wow.
And the second place car happened to be, I think Ivan had some problems. So we had passed him, and the second place car was, Doug Fortin's son and Ryan Thomas.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. They were behind us an hour. So I remember Bob going, coming down and coming over into Constitucion and coming down the hill, and we're radioing the BFG pits as to, you know, where is Gordon? And one of the pits said, well, he had just passed us, so I knew he was getting into Constitucion. By the time we got there, he had already gone by us, so we were going farther down south, and we got to a point, we stopped and trying to get a hold of Bob, and we finally got a hold of him, and the ring and pinion had gone out. So he had got a guy to tow him out and bring him back onto the highway. And we had the pre-runner, which had the same tranny. So we were taking the tranny out and put the tranny back into the race car and get Bob to go again. And here comes Doug Fortin, pulls up, and I'll never forget this. He pulls up and he goes, "What's the matter?" And I said, "Well, we had a ring and pinion." He says, "Well, no wonder you had a ring and pinion problem." I said, "Well, what do you mean by that?" He said, "Well, shit, you had an hour lead and you're running the car too hard." And I said to myself, "Whoa." You know, I was ready to just punch him, and I didn't want to punch him. But I'm saying, let me tell you something. If I took my driving suit off and showed you my right leg where it's black and blue from my co-driver smacking me and telling me to short shift all the time, you know, I would probably believe you, but we were taking care of that transmission like nobody would. So anyhow, we got back into the car and Bob finished, and we finished third. But that was kind of when things go against you, and a truly sad situation, because we had that race won.
Yep. That's what happens. You know, it's the terrain, it's the equipment, it's the personnel, it's the people, you know, that are around. I mean, there's the weather, there's so many different factors to try to pull off a win, especially in Baja, that, you know, you almost have to have everything fall into place for you.
No, that's for sure. I mean, they say, you know, the luck and everything else, you have to have a certain amount of luck, but you're totally right in regards to, you know, everything around you, between you, the driver, the co-driver, and all the personnel that you bring down there that helps you out at each pit and everything else. I mean, all that has to mesh together to be able to, you know, go down and hopefully everything goes good. And if everything goes good, the chances of a good finish are really high.
Right. And so you guys, you and your brother still race sports cars?
Yeah. Well, actually Albert has 3 or 4 vintage cars.
Okay.
And he races those, and he bought a Lotus Lotus 11, 1959 Lotus 11, and I drove it probably 8 or 9 times at different vintage car races. And then he still does. He has that in a Porsche and a Lister that he drives. And the main event that we used to go to all the time was the Rolex one in Laguna Seca, and it's in August. And unfortunately, the last 3 years, it's the same weekend as my son's race, Vegas to Reno.
Right.
So Albert just goes up there, and I haven't driven the car in the last 2 years. So
okay,
yeah, but I we did do the Nora race the first inauguration was 2010, and me and Bob called me and asked me if I'd like to do it, and I go, heck yeah, with the two seat car that I was talking about, and we've done it ever since. I think there's like 2 years that we didn't do it last year because something came up and we couldn't do it. So last year we did it was 2021, I think.
Okay, and so, now you're racing it this year?
No, I'm not. Okay. I was gonna race it, and unfortunately I got a slight tear in my right shoulder rotator cuff.
Okay.
And it is with the shifting on, you know, with that type of shifting and what have you, my arm, I think it would have probably torn it more, so I decided not to. But I'm gonna do it one more time next year, and see if we can we won that race overall two times in our class, like seven times. So it's totally enjoy. I mean, if anybody wants to get involved in off-road racing and they have any issues in regards to, you know, the traditional races, the 500, 1,000, San Felipe and what have you, they should do this race. It's a 4-day event, 5-day event now. And let me tell you something, it's something where they can open their eyes to the, what happens down in Baja and have an opportunity to race in the same courses that we race on over the years, and be a little more mellow. It's not a, you know, a point to point and, you know, balls out type race. So it gives you an opportunity to really appreciate what's down in Mexico. And I've got a friend of mine that works here at our office. He's got his own business, but we lease him some spaces. He's building a car and he asked me, where can I go test this? And I said, your great opportunity is to go down to the NOR race. So he's going down there this year to race it.
And one of your family friends, somebody, you know, Robbie Gordon is now running NORA, isn't he?
Yeah. Robbie bought the rights to the NORA deal, and he's the head honcho now, I guess.
Okay.
But now Robbie, actually his son, Max, who's really, really talented, raced with us in, this is 22 was the last one. So he raced with us in 22. And unfortunately we had an issue with the motor, but we got it fixed. I think we finished third in class, but, Robbie came down and did the first, up to San Felipe. And then he had to go to China the following two days or three days after that. So he stopped, and then Max went all the way down with us. And nice. He did a great job.
Excellent. Well, he comes from good stock, that's for sure.
No, I'm telling you, I know exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly right.
So in 2019, you were inducted into the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame, ORMHOF. And what was that like for you?
Oh, it was totally surprised the hell out of me. I mean, it was an honor. A great honor to be able to be inducted. And I don't know how to say it. You go through life, and you know, you have a lot of things, maybe a lot of goals to, you know, to accomplish, set yourself up and try to accomplish. And one of the things with me is always, if I'm going to do something, I want to do it. I don't want to do it just to do it. I want to do it to be able to compete and win. And I just, when my son, actually, he's the one that put everything in. And when I got the call from Mark, actually Mark called me, and I was just totally flabbergasted. I said, you got to be kidding me. I said, it's an honor, truly honor. I mean, with all the people that are there, all the names of the great people that are before me, and it was something that I'll cherish for a long time. I had my entire family there, which also made it a really great event, and I'll cherish that for the rest of my life.
Did you, while you were on stage and receiving your honor, did you choke up?
Oh yeah, for sure. Rich, I tell you, I couldn't. In fact, I swear to God, I was gonna, the year before in 18, Bob Gordon because he had passed away.
Right.
And I was supposed to go up to you know, how do I say it? Do the introductions for Bob, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. So Robbie and my son Ryan went up and did it as a duo. And then when this happens to me, and I'm going, oh my God, what am I going to do? And I was just about ready to have Ryan come up with me and stand next to me, and if something happened, read the balance of what I have here, Ryan, because I don't know if I can be able to get through it.
Right.
But it was emotional. It was really emotional. I did do it. I bit my tongue, and I made it through. So
there you go. There you go. And I remember the ceremony. I've been going to the induction dinners. I don't remember the exact year, but it was when it was in Pomona, and from that I walked by it one time because we were there for the off-road expo in Pomona. Uh-huh. And we walked by and I was like, "What is going on here?" And then found out what it was. And then the next year we attended and haven't missed one since. And then being asked to be on the board was awesome. And you know, it's been a pleasure to serve with yourself and especially with Mark. Mark is a real go-getter, and just will not, you know, when he does something, like you said, you know, you like to win, you know, you look at the book, the McMillan, the Big Blue book that he put together. Wow. Yep. The guy is very thorough, very, you know, he's very effective at everything that he does. And, it's been a great pleasure working with you guys.
Oh, I'm telling you, it's you know, Ormhoff. I mean, we wouldn't be where we're at right now. I'm step back. The founding fathers of Ormhoff, and when Rod took it over, and what they did, and then seeing, you know, you have so much to work with, and it's a growing pains. Okay,
right.
The growing pains are the toughest ones because you're not really, you don't think you're accomplishing a lot. Okay, but I tell you what, you start adding up little and little, and when Mark stepped into the program and started doing what he was doing, I mean, look at last year and the year before. I mean, my God, it record numbers. I mean, it just blows me away when you go there. I mean, some of these events are bigger than, you know, I want to say things that you see these movie stars and stuff on these programs on TV and what have you, way bigger than that, way bigger than that. I mean, it's just amazing what he's done. He's a great guy, and he was a great competitor, man. You know, one of the things I remember when you talk about racing is you say to yourself, who are the two or three guys that you need to compete against? Who are the two or three guys that you need to make sure that you can keep up with them and possibly beat them? And Mark was at the top of the list. Ivan was at the top of the list for those vehicles they were driving. And it's just like, you know, those are the guys you got to beat. And when you beat them, you beat the best.
Right. And it's an honor to do that. Yep.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, I tell you what, it's just, I don't know. I wish I could talk like my son talks in regards to getting points across. Cause I kind of talk and then I stray away from what I'm trying to think. I mean, I'm not really good at talking and I wish I was, but I mean, I'd love to be able to go out and sell Ormhoff to million people. I mean, if everybody knew what Ormhoff was doing and how they were doing it, we'd have more people involved than you can probably shake a stick at.
Well, we are in a growth mode, and you know, hopefully that as people listen to your story and Mark McMillan's story, and you know, the people that I've interviewed, and get a more of a feel for who the people are that have been inducted. You know, when I was first going to the Ormhoff inductions and getting introduced to Ormhoff, you know, I looked up there and saw all these names that I saw in the magazines or, you know, in the newspapers and that were legends, and going, wow, you know, this is really cool. But you don't know them. You know, you only know what's been put in front of you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's my goal, is to put more information in front of people, and hopefully that'll attract more people into joining Ormhoff and being part of the what we're trying to do, and that's, you know, to preserve the legacy of our lifestyle.
You know, yeah, and I truly agree. I truly agree. I mean, there's, like I said before, that, you know, you can, you know, everything, how do I say, everything has a growth mode to it. I don't care. Club racing, you know, motorcycle racing, NASCAR racing, IndyCar racing, off-road racing. But if you look at off-road racing compared to all these other forms of racing, there is nothing more, how do I say it? There is nothing more that has a family value. Okay. Everything else in today's environment is all dollars and cent driven.
Right.
Okay. I don't care where it is or how you do it. Off-road racing hasn't lost that appeal as of yet to family members. You get 90% of the people that race off-road racing, their families are down there helping them put stuff together, pitting, all the logistics and everything else. Okay.
That ain't happening in NASCAR Indy.
No, that's all gone. All that stuff is gone. I mean, even IndyCar racing and sports car racing back when my dad was doing it, there's still, if something happened to our car, you'd have the guy next pit over in Mr. Penske or somebody else say, "Hey, what do you need? I need the, you know, blah, blah, blah." They give it to you and you go. Today, you don't even talk to them. The cars are covered. You can't see them. It's just, there's no, what do you call that?
There's no camaraderie.
Camaraderie. That's what I'm trying. There's no camaraderie no more. It's all dollars and cent driven. And I'm just hoping that, you know, I don't think off-road will ever get that way, but, you can see it. And I've seen it over the years in all the forms of racing that I've been involved with, like I told you, but off-road, I tell you what, that family value is there and it'll stay there from now until eternity. And what we need to do as a group is to keep that momentum going. And my grandkids, I take them out to the races when we're out here watching my son Ryan race. They all come to the Mint race. They all go to Vegas to Reno, and getting them to understand what's going on and perpetuate this as each generation comes on. Okay. Off-road will never change. You always have the obstacles and everything else out in the desert. Okay. And those are the things that are challenging for us to fix something that we can beat that. Okay. We can beat the terrain and not have the terrain beat us. Right. And it takes a family to do that.
Very well said. Very well said. So what would be your advice to somebody, say like the guy that's in your building, that's getting ready to race, building a car, and you told him to go race Nora. Say somebody walked up to you and said, you know, "Mr. R. Sierra, how do I get into racing, or what do I need to do to be successful at racing?" What would your advice be?
Well, my advice would be, first of all, you want to do racing, off-road racing. Have you ever been to an event, okay, to see what it really takes? And I'd say if you haven't, then what we need to do is, let's go to a race. I mean, a local race someplace, the Barstow or someplace else, so you can understand what's going on. And then if you've never driven an off-road car and you want to do that, then my suggestion is you start at a lesser class, maybe a class 10 or even now that they're expensive, but I mean, the 10 or one of the other, lower classes and get a feel for it. Or the other thing is, since Nora came on board in 2010, that is a great stomping grounds for people to get their feet wet into off-road racing and go down and it's not you're not on ends, you know, you're not stressed out or anything.
Yeah, it's not
three,
such an endurance
4-day
race.
Event.
Right.
It's not. And you got one day, you sleep, next day you go and you go down to the finish and you see what it's about and then make a decision as to what class or what you want to do. I mean, unfortunately in today's environment, Rich, you know, trophy trucks are multi-million dollar programs. Okay.
Right.
And it's really difficult for the average person to do that. So we've got a lot of classes in off-road racing that they can come out and they can build a car and compete. And that's what my deal would be, is to first go out and understand what you're getting into, and then build something that you can compete with. And then as you go, you start building relationships with BFG, Toyota, Bridgestone, or somebody that sees your talent and can help you to the next step, and then to the next step, and then to the next step. You can't just do it overnight.
True. True. So one last question. How did you get the nickname Butch?
To be honest with you, I mean, everybody asked me that question. And the only thing I can say is my name was Frank and my dad's name was Frank. So when my mom used to get mad at my dad and say something about Frank, then I'd get up and I think she's yelling at me. And so she decided one day we went in, I needed a haircut. I was playing football, Pop Warner football, I think, or something. And she said, I need to get a, you know, at that time they wanted you to get a mohawk, or not a mohawk, but you know, cut your hair off like in the army.
Right.
And then she looked, hey, so that's they called it a Butch haircut.
Yep.
And she goes, well, that's what I'm going to call you now. I'm going to call you Butch. So now when I call Frank, you don't have to step up because that's your dad.
So that's how you became known as Frank. As Butch.
That's how I got as Butch. Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Excellent. I have to say I in the 60s, I was born in 58, so it was mid 60s. Late 60s, and my hair was kind of long, and you know, like most kids in the San Francisco Bay Area or California were, and I can remember my mom saying, hey, you know, you're on your way down to go get a haircut, and I said, yep, and she goes, I heard of this new haircut called a burro. You should get one of those. Well, I wasn't thinking too smart, because a burro's hair is not long. Right?
Yeah, sure, no.
So I go in, my buddy is with me, my buddy Jeff is with me, and he's sitting there right across from the barber's chair, and the guy goes, you sure you want this cut? And I said, yep. And he just started in the middle and just took it right down. I mean, I was 12, maybe 13, and Jeff laughs to this day about that haircut, because, you know, it was emotional for me.
No, I don't doubt that at all.
It was very emotional. My God. All my hair was gone.
Oh, my God. No. So no, I know. I tell you, when I got that Butch, too, I was saying to myself the same thing. I figured, okay, it's still going to be a little bit. But no, it was down to nothing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And listen, I want to interject one other thing, too.
Sure.
One thing in regards, you asked me about a time and a situation, but when you asked me did it occur, if it occurred and when it occurred in Mexico. Right. I have a good story.
Okay.
And I'd like to just tell you the story is Art, the first race we had in the mid 400, me and my brother. Okay. We went out and did our pre-run, and then we go to the driver's meeting. Okay. So we're sitting at the driver's meeting, and it's me, my brother, and my dad happened to go with us to the driver's meeting. And so the walk gets through with the driver's meeting and what have you. So we're getting up, ready to walk out. And here comes Parnelli. He walks over and my dad says, hey, Parnelli, because he drove the Lotus 23, I think a couple, two, three times, prior to this year, that year that we raced.
Okay.
And so my dad knew him pretty well. So Parnelli goes, so my dad says, Parnelli, he says, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm here, you know, he knew I was racing and what have you. He says, well, what are you doing here? He said, well, my two sons are racing. He says, they are, huh? He says, here, Albert, this is Parnelli Jones. Butch, this is Parnelli Jones. How you doing, Mr. Jones? Blah, blah, blah. So first thing Parnelli says is, who's driving the car? So Albert says, well, I'm starting. He said, what's your starting number? He says, my number is, I think at the time, I think we were 96. And Parnelli in that race was 118 or 120 or something like that. And then it was just the draw. Okay. You can have a Baja Bug start, you know, you have a class 10 car, a class 1 car, and it was just a draw. So we're at those numbers. So Parnell looks at Albert and he goes, hey, he says, okay. He says, listen, he says, when I come up to you, he says, I'm going to honk. And then I'm gonna honk, and then I'm gonna tap you, and then I'm gonna push you out of the way, and that's all gonna happen within 3 seconds. So Albert's he's going, oh my God. He said, good luck and blah, blah, and he leaves. So Albert, he couldn't sleep that night. So he's getting up and figured out, okay, we should get in the car. And now he's worrying. The race started. It was right. The road that goes up over the hill when you get into what the hell's the name of that road? Anyhow, it started right outside of town, and then it went over and it came near state line and then back over the hill and what have you. So Albert's going, oh my God. So he's worried. No, she gets in the car, takes off. So now all he's thinking about is Parnelli Jones coming up to him, right? So after about 15, 20 minutes or whatever the hell he's in the car, all of a sudden he hears Parnelli coming. He heard the horn and he hear the noise in that car. So he pulls over and Parnelli goes by. So Albert goes, oh, thank God. So now he's not only starting to concentrate on the race, he goes another about 3 miles and he sees Parnelli on the top of this Baja Bug or whatever. His car is on top of him. And Albert goes, oh, shoot. And he goes, shit, now he's going to have another chance to come get me. So Parnelli gets in the car and, you know, gets back out and takes off and wins the race. So now in 2010 for the Nora race, okay, we're starting the race in Mexicali. And over the years now, between then and now, Parnelli and Albert are kind of, you know, he's not doing real well, but him and Albert are good friends, really good friends. They used to go a lot of vacations together and everything else. So Parnelli now is the grand marshal for the Nora race, and he's got his pre-runner that he's going to race, and he's the first man off the line. So I'm sitting there after the driver's meeting, and Parnelli is sitting over there next to Walker, and they're bullshitting. So I walk over to him. And he say, Parnelli, he say, Butch, what are you doing? I said, nothing. I said, how you doing? He says, good. I says, hey, Parnelli, where are you starting? And he says, well, I'm the first car off the road. I says, you are? I says, shit, we were the 89th car off the road. And I says, hey, okay. I says, hey, listen, Parnelli. He says, when I get up to you, I'm going to honk, I'm going to hit you, and then I'm going to push you out of the way. And that's all going to happen within 3 seconds. And he looked at me. He looked at me and he said, and then all of a sudden it clicked on him as to what I said. You know, I said to myself, hey, now I got the chance to do this.
That's
but
awesome.
That was a cute story. I thought that was really cool.
That's the kind of stories I'm looking for. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
So,
well,
all right.
Well, Butch, Frank, Arciero, I want to say thank you so much for spending the time and getting this interview done. I really enjoyed it. I had a smile on my face the whole time. And I'm looking forward to meeting you in person. I've sat by your guys' table a couple of times during the previous events, but at the gala this year or some other event, I hope to be able to get a chance to shake your hand.
Oh, I will for sure. I mean, you come up, you grab me or whatever. I'd love to meet you personally too, and thank you for all you're doing for being on the board and all the stuff you're doing for Ormhoff. And together, we're all going to get Ormhoff to the next step.
I agree.
Next level for sure.
There you go. All right. Thank you, Butch, and you have a great day. The rest of your day, and we'll see you.
You too, Rich. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Have a good time.
Okay. You
all
too.
Right.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Well, that's another episode of Conversations with Big Rich. I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you could do us a favor and leave us a review on any podcast service that you happen to be listening on, or send us an email or a text message or a Facebook message, and let me know any ideas that you have, or if there's anybody that you have that you think would be a great guest, please forward the contact information to me so that we can try to get them on. And always remember, live life to the fullest. Enjoying life is a must. Follow your dreams and live life with all the gusto you can. Thank you.